It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 702 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 2nd, 2021. All the messages I got this week, Solo Monster. Ryback posted another poll. Are you going to give Ryback the award again for said tweet? I am not. Because he is just trolling for attention now. So do not give him the attention that he seeks. I will, however, give it to Andrew Yang, who is running for mayor here in New York City, and it has nothing to do with him running for mayor, or even anything new that he posted on Twitter recently, but as I was reading a headline about his mayoral aspirations, I thought back to all of those tweets that he posted last year, both before and after Zelina Vega got fired by WWE, about how he was coming after Vince McMahon and putting Vince McMahon on notice, and how if he wasn't the Secretary of Labor in a possible new administration, he would have that person's phone number to talk to them about the classification of WWE stars as independent contractors while controlling their name and their likeness. He wasn't going to let this issue go. Well, here we are, 8 months later, and I am still anxiously awaiting an update on how that conversation went. What do you think the odds are that conversation even happened yet? You know, I think he'll do all right as a politician. I don't know what kind of mayor he would make, but I think he'll fit right in. Someone who was talking some sense this week was Kurt Angle. On his Kurt Angle Show podcast, he did a little Q&A version of his podcast with Conrad this week. And he talked about, in answering someone's question, he talked about why he thinks Bret the Hitman Hart is the greatest wrestler of all time. He was asked a question about Bret, and those were his exact words. He also said Bret was the best overall technician that he ever saw in his life. He was talking about how Shawn Michaels is great, Chris Benoit, these people, himself. But he put Bret at the top of that list. How about that? Talk about high praise. And that is a match that we never got to see that we were all deprived of. Bret Hart against Kurt Angle in their primes. That would have been something special. If you wanted to hear my thoughts on Mick Foley's insane tweet this week, or hear me recite the famous Scott Steiner Steiner Math promo, or the work shoot that Joey Styles dropped on Raw many years ago. Got that coming up in the history segment. This is the week for you. Shout out to those of you who took advantage so far of our Audible offer. Drew McIntyre has a new book on his life and his career coming out this Tuesday. Last week, you could pre-order it. You can still pre-order it, but you may as well wait. If you want, until Tuesday, May 4th, this week, A Chosen Destiny, My Story. And if you use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster, 30-day trial of the service, you can get Drew McIntyre's book, narrated by McIntyre himself, for free. So go ahead and take advantage of that, audibletrial.com/solomonster. But I have an even cooler offer for you. Take advantage of this because this runs out May 24th. This is a limited time offer. You can get 3 free months of Amazon Music now through May 24th when you use our link, getamazonmusic.com/solomonster. I was talking a little bit about this on the Wednesday stream. I'm big on, you know, music streaming stuff on my phone. So I have a subscription to Pandora. I've got one to Spotify. I've used Amazon Music as well. YouTube Music has a thing of their own. It's great stuff. If you're big into music, playlists, working out at the gym, you're looking for something to listen to, you can get it for 3 months free on this podcast. So take advantage. GetAmazonMusic.com/Solomonster. Every time you use our link, you help out the show. If you'd like to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Like these fine folks, including the Angel of Anarchy, Lucas Kroll. I already emailed you, Lucas, but wow. Thank you, sir. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Killshot Keith Hart, Evil Dose, Jeff Lippman, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, and Guitar Hero John Kiernan, who is out with a brand new entrance theme for an independent wrestler who calls himself the Honorable Malcolm Flex. It is a tune called Outstanding, featuring This Wolf. Here's a sample. You can find the song's lyric video on YouTube by searching the name Malcolm Flex Theme, that's P-H-L-E-X, or by searching for John directly at John Kiernan and or John Kiernan It Lives, It Breathes. Got more shoutouts coming up in a little bit, but first, I got some news and notes to lay on you. We're going to start out here with Impact and AEW. I watched the Impact Rebellion main event last Sunday. I already talked about it on the Dynamite stream if you tuned in on Wednesdays, which if you're not, you should be. Very good match between Kenny Omega and Rich Swann. Winner take all with Omega winning the Impact World title. It was really good hearing Mauro Ranallo's voice back on wrestling commentary. He sounds like he's very much open to doing it again. And that is a phone call that Tony Khan needs to make when they have that second TNT show ready to go in the fall. And despite AEW doing the bare minimum to promote the match, Rebellion looks to be the biggest Impact pay-per-view in years. Now, it's nowhere close to the biggest. That still belongs to the Kurt Angle Samoa Joe cage match show that did nearly 60,000 buys. It was somewhere between 55 and 60,000 pay-per-view buys. And that is still, to this day, the biggest Impact pay-per-view buy rate they've ever done. This doesn't look to be anywhere close to that, but for a modern-day Impact show, it did extremely well. Or at least the early indicators are that it did extremely well. They have two shows coming up. Under Siege, it's a great Steven Seagal movie. And Against All Odds, coming up in May and June. These are not traditional pay-per-views before their Slammiversary show in July, which is their next big pay-per-view show. Under Siege will feature a six-man match to determine the first challenger to Omega's title. I think when Omega loses the title, Moose may be the best choice. But he should not be losing the Impact title before he loses the AEW title. That loss should come first, and even that loss should not come for a while. Now, this Wednesday is the big Blood and Guts match on Dynamite with the Pinnacle getting the man advantage, and Sammy Guevara turning, he turned out a promo on Wednesday night, and they all did, really. Turned out great promos, but Sammy in his promo talked about, I don't care, I'll go first. So apparently, Sammy Guevara, I guess, is going to start things out for the Inner Circle. I'm going to be live on YouTube as soon as that show is over, just after 10 p.m. Come on over to YouTube. I'll be live talking about Blood and Guts. It's two rings under War Games rules, submission or surrender only. They had their parlay on Wednesday between the two groups. And that segment is the sort of segment that other promotions should study on how to sell a major match, because we've already seen these two groups go at it, and fight. And I would argue that, you know, I'm not even sure, frankly, that that should have happened. I probably would have held off on that a little bit. But we've already seen them, you know, beating each other up. So there was no point in having some kind of big pull-apart brawl or anything like that. You save it for the pay-per-view, or not even a pay-per-view. You save it for the match, right, on the 5th. This was simply both teams, and Jericho says he got the whole parlay name and idea from watching Pirates of the Caribbean, apparently. But I thought the promo work was stellar. You know, Sean Spears, you know, what it was okay. But the promo work from Jericho, the promo work from MJF, the little bit we got from Santana, you know, Wardlow kept his mouth shut. Jake Hager kept his mouth shut, which was for the better. I thought overall, though, the promo work here was fantastic. The Pinnacle has to win. There is absolutely no reason for the Inner Circle to win this match. And I think it's going to be Chris Jericho that surrenders for his team. I can't see either member of LAX submitting. Sammy Guevara, I mean, I guess I could see it, but I would envision a scenario where the Pinnacle is really threatening to do something heinous to Sammy, and Jericho surrenders to save his boy. So that's my prediction. And then that could cause some friction coming out of the event that leads to all the members of the Inner Circle going their own way. We may see the Inner Circle dissolve after this, because what really is left for them to do as a unit? I think Santana and Ortiz can go on out on their own, right, and have a very successful run challenging for the tag team titles. Sammy could go do his thing, and Jericho could do his. Hager, I don't know. I don't know where he goes. Maybe Jericho keeps him on as a bodyguard or something. I don't know. But that would be my prediction for how the match goes on Wednesday. They're also going to be airing other matches. It is not a one-match show. They're airing Cody against QT Marshall. Kenny Omega and Michael Nakazawa take on Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston. And SCU, Jurassic Express, Varsity Blondes, and The Acclaimed will have a four-way elimination match with the winning team getting a tag team title match on the May 12th episode of Dynamite. That should be SCU, and what would be SCU's final match together when they lose, because they are going to lose. And remember, the next match they do lose will be their last. This is a story that has been largely ignored on Dynamite now for several months, so it doesn't feel as big of a deal as it should. But the angle to set all of this up didn't air on Dynamite either. I mean, back in December, when Kazarian laid it all out for Daniels and said, look, you and I, the next match we lose, that's it for SCU. That was on a Britt Baker waiting room segment that I think aired on YouTube, on Dark. And that's kind of how this whole thing has been treated now ever since. They never really played it up as much as they could have. But also on that May 12th show, Jon Moxley is going to defend his IWGP United States Championship, the first defense of that IWGP US title on AEW television, on TNT. And he's going to be defending it against Yuji Nagata in a deal that was brokered months ago, per The Observer. Hopefully the first of many more like it in the months to come, especially once they take the show back on the road in front of bigger crowds. You know, I said this on Wednesday. It's exciting to hear that. Not because I'm like a huge Yuji Nagata fan. I know who Yuji Nagata is. The guy's in his 50s. He's, you know, he's still able to go in there and put on a good match. Not his first time on TNT. He was on some of those Nitro shows back in the WCW days. Former IWGP champion himself. But it's what it represents. The first of what is to come. There's a lot of bigger names, bigger than Yuji Nagata right now, who I would like to see come over from New Japan and wrestle on AEW television. And I'm sure as things open up a little bit more travel-wise and it becomes a little bit easier, and again, they can get back on the road and they're not just in Jacksonville every week, we will get to see more of that. And after all of the drama with NBC shuttering its NBC Sports channel at the end of this year, and all the talk of them shifting NHL games over to USA Network, Then NXT goes and they move to Tuesdays. What happens? Turner Sports swoops in and signs a 7-year deal with the NHL worth over $1 billion, with some games very likely to air on TNT and not USA. You could not script a swerve like that if you tried. It sent a tingle up Vince Russo's leg when he heard the news. Now, we don't know if games are going to air on TNT or TBS or both. And even if they do, it would not be for a while yet. So this is not going to have any short-term effect at all on AEW. I talked about this, again, a few days ago. Tony Khan, that same day when I talked about this, that morning, he went on Busted Open Radio and he said, look, we have a contract with Turner for Wednesdays. He said for the right price, he might be willing to move the show if he was asked to, but they're not moving nights. Now, this would be more likely to affect the second show on TNT, especially if that show airs on Saturday nights, which I think is the likeliest night for that show, then that could have an impact. But for all of Tony Khan's proclamations, though, about Wednesdays being their night, we find out that the NBA playoffs are going to be booting Dynamite from its usual slot for 2 straight weeks, and it comes at the worst possible time. The go-home show to Double or Nothing later this month and the post-pay-per-view edition of Dynamite, both are being preempted. The Wednesday, May 26th episode will instead air after SmackDown at 10 p.m. on Friday, May 28th. And the Wednesday, June 6th show will air either on Friday, June 4th or Saturday, June 5th. That depends on which playoff game TNT gets. So right now, it is the NBA they should be worried about, not the NHL. There was an interesting item in this week's Observer about a potential working relationship between WWE and MLW. According to Meltzer, or Court Bauer, I mean, the way this was written, it could really be either one of them. WWE does not like the reputation that it has, that it does not work with anyone in the modern wrestling world. And so they are reportedly in talks with MLW along the lines of WWE's earlier deal with Evolve or ECW in the 90s, where they would have a place to send some of their developmental talent to go work at a time when, you know, a lot of them are not getting much work, just hanging around the performance center. There are no live events. PW Insider, in regards to this report, said that there are no such talks ongoing. I don't believe there ever were talks. I don't believe there will be talks. I think this is a promoter playing promoter, and trying to get people talking. It is no coincidence that this news comes right when MLW is starting up on Vice TV. In fact, they just premiered on the network yesterday. They're going to be running highlight shows until they start running events in front of fans this summer. Then they'll start putting first-run programming on Vice. Bauer knows what he's doing. I don't believe there's anything at all to this. And look, if there was, okay, let's say there was, and you're MLW, you need to tread very lightly. We know how these things end, usually with an acquisition. But we know how these things go. An acquisition, or them just becoming WWE's new feeder system, and, you know, sometimes that perception can work against you. It's not a bad thing to be friendly with WWE. I mean, I'd rather be their friend than their enemy, but you've got to be careful with things like this. I don't know how MLW fans would feel about that. I think different promotions working together can be a good thing. It's why I like AEW working with New Japan and with Impact and with the NWA. I think it can benefit both sides. Most of all, it benefits the fans. Just opens up, you know, the potential pool of matches so much more. But WWE does not play well with others. And if they do want to play, you can bet they have an ulterior motive involved. They're not doing it to help anybody else. If you think WWE is going to start working with other promotions because, oh, they're worried about their reputation, that they don't work with anyone else, which is not true. I mean, they do have working agreements with some of the smaller UK promotions, as we know. They had one with Evolve before they swallowed them up. Do you think WWE cares? Do you think they care that the wrestling community has this, to these fans, they have a bad rep of not working with other people? You think they're going to start working with these promotions to give them a boost, help them out? Especially a promotion like MLW that has television. If they didn't have television in this country, maybe they wouldn't mind. You know? That's why WWE probably doesn't mind forming these alliances with these UK promotions. It's not like they have to worry about them in this country being on TV. MLW is not only on Vice. You know, they're on beIN Sport. They're supposedly working on additional television deals, national television. So, you know, if this is a case of MLW floating something, which is what I think this is, with the hope that perhaps they can manufacture something out of it and get WWE's ear, be careful what you wish for. Let's talk about Andrade. Andrade has been in the news quite a bit this week, including last night. He was trending on Twitter. Andrade's first post-WWE appearances have been announced. The first involves his buddy Rush, who is starting up his own promotion in Mexico called Federación Wrestling. They held a press conference on Friday to announce their first pay-per-view for June 19th. Andrade will team with Rush, Bestia del Ring, and a mystery partner against Ring of Honor stars Matt Taven, PJ Black, and two mystery partners of their own. AEW stars Penta and Rey Fénix will take on Bandido and Dragon Lee, Red Velvet, Ty Conti, they're going to be appearing on the show as well. As such, CMLL, which is the oldest wrestling promotion in the world, I mean, they've been around for close to a century now, terminated its long-standing partnership with Ring of Honor because they don't play nice with Rush anymore after they fired him from the promotion a couple of years ago. They did not part on the best of terms, and now he's turning around and he's basically competing against them. It's more competition in the marketplace down in Mexico. So, you know, Ring of Honor kind of got fucked here because their hands were tied to do anything. They can't, I guess they can't stop their talent from appearing on the show if they want to, just based on their contract. So that ends the relationship between ROH and CMLL. I guess ROH is going to be working with Rush's promotion going forward. You can buy your tickets using cryptocurrency or PayPal. And LuchaBlog pointed out that the PayPal address, the PayPal email address to send money for this Federación Wrestling show is listed as brutalsexmusic@gmail.com. Maybe wait and buy tickets at the door if you are thinking about going. Then last night, Andrade appeared in a pre-taped video at the AAA Rey de Reyes event challenging Kenny Omega to a match for the AAA Mega title that Omega holds at Triple Mania later this year. Currently, it has no date. Probably looking late summer, early fall for Triple Mania. That should be, if it happens, that should be a hell of a match. And I would have to think that would probably be the end of Omega's run with that belt. You know, he's had that championship for 2 years, or almost 2 years now. And the pandemic is a big reason why, because he couldn't defend it for so long. He's had a couple of defenses since then. But if this match goes off, I would think in a few months, Andrade probably is walking out with that belt. But do not let all of this good news distract from the third match that Andrade has signed on for against Alberto Del Dipshit at a Nación Lucha Libre show July 31st in McAllen, Texas. This is a show that Alberto claims will also feature Kalisto, Sin Cara, Primo and Epico, Sexy Star, another winner, and Blue Demon Jr., who himself was just accused by his wife of 20 years of spousal abuse. This all comes as word came down on Friday that Del Rio's sexual assault trial is going to begin tomorrow, this Monday. And this stems from the alleged assault that took place last May, for which he was charged in October. He was charged in October. In case you forgot, allow me to remind you. He was accused of assaulting his girlfriend after accusing her of being unfaithful to him. He forced her to wear a dress and dance for him, and then he violently assaulted her sexually over a 16-hour period. The woman went to the police with bruises all over her face, her neck, her arms, her legs. And she alleged that he tried to burn her passport, he destroyed her computer and cell phone. He threatened to take her son and drop him in the middle of the road somewhere if she didn't stop crying before ultimately going ahead and assaulting her. That is what he is accused of. And if he is convicted, and I don't think this is going to happen, that this will be the punishment, but if he is convicted, he could potentially face life in prison. That's how serious the charges are against him. Now, in November, there was an Instagram post that supposedly came from the woman who went to the cops and levied the accusations that, when translated from Spanish, included an apology to Alberto's family for the damage caused by her, quote, errors or mistakes. That post has since been deleted. You can't find it anywhere. And if the translation is accurate, you know, for all the people saying, oh, well, you know, she apologized for lying, that wasn't true. Or, you know, I think Alberto's brother said, oh, she, you know, recanted her story. Nowhere in that post did she recant any of the allegations against him. Yeah, that as Del Rio's brother claimed at the time that she was admitting the story was made up. That is not what happened. Now, it is entirely possible that she will recant her story. Maybe that'll come out during the trial. But that has not happened. She is not the first woman to accuse this man of physical abuse. But he will have his day in court, and that will determine his fate. But in the meantime, you know, for anyone to want to work with this guy is repulsive. I'm not surprised. There have been a lot of real shitbags in wrestling who have done some dumb shit who somehow still find work because they have a name or ooh, they can make money or they're a draw. You know, don't forget, no matter how much, you know, you have a company like WWE who try with this big corporate image, wrestling is still a very scummy business. Now, maybe there's fewer scummy people than there would have been 30 years ago. I don't know. But you do tend to find a lot of these types of people, unfortunately, in the wrestling business, and these people will consistently find work somehow. Because there's only one thing that matters. Can you make money? If you are a star, or if you were once a star, and they feel they can make money with you, you will find work. No matter how big or small the promotion may be, you will find work. You know, and it's not even just the accusations against them. You know, here's a guy, from a business point of view, if you're a promoter, hasn't this guy no-showed tons of events in the past? He hasn't exactly proven to be the most reliable. I know he had issues with Impact as well. I'm not sure why you would even trust him in the first place. If you were booking him for your show, why would you even trust that he would show up? But with these types of charges hanging over his head, and you've got Andrade now, you know, before going after Dave Meltzer for his comments about Charlotte. And I understand it's his fiance, so he's sticking up for her. But, he, you know, he's going after, you know, Meltzer and his comments about women in WWE. And here, the first match that he was announced for before any of this other stuff is a match against Del Dipshit. Doesn't speak very highly to Andrade's judgment. But we already knew that. After the interview he did where Charlotte then had to come out when he was talking about her, the you know, false pregnancy and some other personal shit that obviously she did not want him talking about because she had to come out with a statement and walk back the comments and clarify the comments. We already knew that Andrade was not the sharpest tool in the shed. We got some more shouts. Thank you to Ostentatious Alan Carter, the Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton, the 90s Vampire Eddie Valens, The Bakersfield Big Shot, Steve Heredia, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, and Belt Fan Brent Banner. This week on the How Did We Even Get Here podcast, which I know some of you have been sampling out, which is very cool to hear. Brent and Trey, they're joined by former bartender and current author of Not Literary, Ariane DeRutter, for part one of their wildest, most off-the-charts episodes so far. The hilarious books written by this maniac pixie dream girl can be found at ArianeDeRutter.com. That's AurianeDeRutter.com. You can find the episode by searching How Did We Even Get Here, wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or on YouTube at tinyurl.com/gethere tube. Gotten a lot of questions and messages from people asking me if I was going to talk about any of the WWE programming that's been airing the last few weeks on A&E. So I just want to take a few minutes here just to talk about some of the stuff that I've seen. I did watch the biographies on Stone Cold Steve Austin and Rowdy Roddy Piper. I briefly mentioned the Austin documentary, the biography, last week. I didn't have much more to say about it because, you know, as with the Piper one, there really wasn't a whole lot of new ground. You know, if you're a hardcore wrestling fan, you pretty much know the story. You've seen the DVD documentaries for Piper and Austin that WWE has done. You know, the A&E ones, they're done in partnership with WWE. So anything overly controversial, they're not going to cover it, or they're going to cover it in their own way because they're in bed with WWE. So again, you're not really breaking much in the way of new ground. You know, that said, I think they're well done. I enjoyed watching both of them. The next one is Randy Savage. The Macho Man documentary premieres tonight. It's every Sunday night. Then there's a Booker T biography, and they have other ones slated for The Ultimate Warrior. Gee, I wonder how much of that one they'll whitewash. Mick Foley, Bret Hart, and Shawn Michaels are all getting the A&E biography treatment. The Piper one, you know, they had this, I don't know if you can call it an outtake or what, but, you know, Vince McMahon is one of the people that is interviewed for these. And they recorded this little segment with him, I guess, as they were preparing to interview him in his office, where Vince has his cell phone, his smartphone in his hand, and he's having this pretend conversation. It's as if Piper is calling him on his phone. And he's talking about it like Piper is, you know, how's the weather down there? Like Piper's in hell. And he's having this conversation with himself. And it's like, oh, Piper's saying, oh, we're saving a spot for you. And Vince is like, well, I'm not ready yet. And he's going through this whole thing. And then he ends the conversation and he starts laughing, like, you know, yucking it up. Like, ah, ha, ha. He goes, oh, Roddy's not in hell. Roddy's in heaven. Like he was just joking. What a bizarre joke. What a weird person. Like, I could just imagine Piper's family sitting down, getting ready to watch this. And they aired this. This was just something they filmed that they probably looked at and go, oh, this is so fucking weird. We have to air this. It's just bizarre. But anyway, but Vince is a bizarre guy, so I guess I shouldn't be really surprised by that. Yeah, the Piper one, like the Austin one, was really good. I guess the one thing I was not aware of, when they talk about Piper right before his death, you know, because he died, he had a heart attack, I think, in his sleep, and passed away, I think it was in 2015, I believe. A few days before he died, he was on the Rich Eisen show in studio, and they did air some clips from that interview, and his family and his kids were talking about how the interview set off a lot of alarm bells, because if you watch it, Piper is just clearly not in a good way. He is stammering and stuttering over his words. He's losing his train of thought. It's not the typical Roddy Piper that you would see in an interview. And they knew something was wrong. And that was only a few days before he died. And the night before he died, his wife, Kitty, is interviewed as well. And his wife said that they were going to go to the doctor the next day. She had talked to him and they said, okay, we're going to the doctor the next day to get you checked out, to see what's going on. He agreed to go. And that was the night that he passed away. And she was grateful. She was very emotional, obviously, but she said she was grateful that he died at home, in bed with her, because so often he was on the road, even that late in his life. He was still traveling and doing interviews and TV shows and movie cameos and wrestling appearances and convention appearances. And so much of his life was spent on the road. That could have easily happened. He could have died alone in a hotel room like so many other wrestlers that we've heard about over the years and so many of his friends and his colleagues. And it just so happened that he was at home with his wife. And so that's the one thing that she said she was grateful for. So I must have seen the interview at some point, but having watched the clips of it here, I didn't realize when you really watch and listen to it, yeah, there's definitely something off about him in that interview. And I didn't realize that. And I didn't realize he had died, whatever it was, you know, 2, 3, 4 days after that. So that's something new, I guess, that I did learn. One common theme so far in the first couple of these is how these guys, how much these guys put the business and their work before their families. And they were barely home. And they were not father of the year. Piper tried to be, more so Austin, and he admits it. He was not a good father. He basically is only now in his life is trying to repair and form relationships with his daughters that he just didn't have. You know, when he had the divorce with his wife, Jeannie, she moved, you know, she went to England. I think as he explained, this is around the time of 9/11. So they weren't able to come back to the States so quickly. And he remembers one day having a conversation on the phone with one of his daughters. And his daughter had the Southern Texas accent that he has before that. But when he talked to her on the phone, she had a British accent. And he said he broke down after that phone call because it just kind of hit him. Like, wow. Like, I don't even know my own kids. They're just, you know, they have this totally different life overseas. And I don't have any kind of real knowledge of what's going on with my children. So at least he's self-aware about it. At least he admits it. But man, it's these guys are not going to win Father of the Year. And it also hit me that 30 years from now, the documentaries on this current era of stars, by comparison, are going to be boring as shit. Oh my God. But don't get me wrong. You know, I'm glad that a lot of these guys are probably, hopefully, going to live to a ripe old age without their hearts exploding at 50. Or dropping dead in their hotel room at 40. We can leave those days behind. And the stories of guys being on the road 300 days a year and never seeing their families. There have been a lot of positive changes. But those stories from 30, 40 years ago, coming up in the territory days and all the crazy shit those guys were doing. And back at a time when more people believed if you were a heel, you'd have to fight for your life. Just to get back to the dressing room without being hit with a battery or having urine thrown on you or being stabbed or attacked in some way, which is horrible. But those days, I mean, those days are long gone, you know, and you have to say it does make for a more interesting story than someone who basically grew up in WWE, which is the case with a lot of these guys. What's the Baron Corbin documentary going to look like in 30 years? Can you imagine that? What it was like coming up at the Performance Center? Oh yeah, what an exciting story that'll be, you know? What's the most controversial thing they'll be able to cover? Something they tweeted? Creative didn't use me properly? These documentaries are going to be a bore, I'm telling you right now. Now the other show that's been airing on A&E, again, working in tandem with WWE to produce this show called WWE's Most Wanted Treasures. Now, I like it because I'm into stuff like this. The basic concept, it's almost like their version of porn stars. that's a very different show that would not be airing on A&E. Pawn Stars. It's kind of like that. And they have this guy. It's basically it's a scripted reality show. It is 100% a scripted reality show, as most reality television is. AJ Francis is a former NFL star. I think he played for the Giants, actually. Now he's been training for the last year, year and a half, at the WWE Performance Center. So he's training to become a WWE star. But they have him as one of the stars. He's one of the hosts of the show. He's one of the wrestling nerds who is, like me and probably a lot of you, who's into this kind of stuff, who's into the memorabilia and, collecting shit. So the premise of each episode is, on behalf of Triple H, who is sending AJ out there to find some of these items that they want to collect and bring back in-house to WWE. AJ will go out with a particular wrestler to try to collect some of their own memorabilia. They obviously have a lead on who has it and where it is. It's not lost. It's not lost treasures. They know exactly where this shit is. But the premise is to convince this fan, or whoever is in possession of it, to give it up. Or to sell it. What do you want for it? And Triple H is on the show. Stephanie McMahon is on the show. It's weird a little bit seeing these, legendary figures go up to, this random fan's house, ring the doorbell, walk into their man cave and say, "Hey, you've got my, piece of gum that I chewed. I'd like to buy it back from you." I don't know. It's a little strange as these guys venture out and try to get back their old stuff. But the first episode had Mick Foley. And Foley with, AJ Francis, he goes out. And he's looking for a few different things. He's looking for an original Mr. Socko. He's looking for the original Mankind shirt or vest that he wore when he made his debut. One of the fans that they run into, they go to this person's house. He is a huge collector of Cactus Jack memorabilia. So he's a huge Mick Foley fan, huge Cactus Jack fan. And they find that he has a ring-worn Cactus Jack flannel vest. And Foley tries it on, and he's like, "Yep, this is official." He goes, it's signed, this is the real deal. And they go, "Well, look, we wanna buy it from you." And the guy's like, "Yeah, no, I can't give that up. It's like a crown jewel of my collection." So they offer him $2,500 for it, this used ring-worn vest. He says no. So they up the offer to $3,500. He says no. And you know what? Good for him. You might think, "Whoa, the guy's nuts. $3,500, take the money." You underestimate the money people are willing to spend on rare pieces of memorabilia and rare artifacts, whether it's at auction or on eBay or whatever. People are willing to spend top dollar. And as time goes on, if there's only going to be a handful of ring-worn items like this. And especially as these guys get older and they start to die off, you're going to find that a lot of this stuff is going to shoot up in value. So it kind of sounds crazy, but you know what? It's really not. He said no to the offer. So Foley promises him a tour of the WWE warehouse in Connecticut. And they have this very phony scene where they, him and AJ go outside the house and they FaceTime Triple H and Ben Brown, who's the official archivist there for them, who runs the whole warehouse. And Foley's like, "Well, I kind of sort of promised this guy, that I would give him a tour," and Triple H... The whole thing is so fake. But anyway, they convince the guy, "Okay, yeah, that sounds good. Maybe if I go get a tour, maybe if I see something I like, maybe we could do an even exchange." And they give this guy a tour. And by the way, if you're like a long-term WWE fan and you're into this kind of stuff, that place is like the holy grail. I can only imagine the kind of shit they've got in there. I would love to get a tour. If they gave tours of the warehouse and had, like, at the very end of your tour, they had, like, a little store that, even if it wasn't the official items, they almost created, like, copycat versions that you can buy or something, I'd be the first person there. I will readily admit, I'd be all over a tour like that. But this guy's getting the grand tour, and they're in a room, and he looks over, and he goes, "Oh." And he finds what is the 2x4. Wrapped in barbed wire. And I don't know if it was the one wrapped in the real barbed wire or the one wrapped in the rubber-tipped barbed wire. Because if you watch the street fight with Triple H and Cactus Jack at the Royal Rumble in 2000, they had a real one. And there's clearly a moment where it gets hidden under one of the announce desks. Later on, they go to retrieve it. And that's the rubber-tipped one. So I don't know which one it was. But apparently it's one of the 2x4s that were used in that match. So again, pretty rare stuff. And the guy is standing there. And it must have been the rubber-tipped one, because the guy's got the bat in his hand. He's stroking this barbed wire 2x4. And he goes, I'll tell you what. I'll give you the Cactus Jack vest in exchange for this, and then throw $2,500 in there on top of that. And Ben the archivist says, you got a deal. I want to cultivate a relationship with you. They shake on it, and they make the deal. So they got the vest. This guy gets to take home a barbed wire wrapped 2x4, which I'm sure was just great on his commute home. Going home with that. Hey, honey, look what I got. So that was that. And then there's a different part of the episode where Foley, he reenacts the Mr. McMahon hospital scene where Sacco debuted. He surprises Vince McMahon. Stephanie McMahon is telling Mick, okay, we're going to surprise my father in his office. And it's this whole scene with Vince and he's, you know, acting the part. Whatever. The second episode, I thought, was way more interesting. The second episode had Undertaker and Kane featured. And some of the cool stuff, you know, they go to... So this guy AJ is with Undertaker, and they go to Kane's house. They go to Mayor Kane's house. And Kane goes into his basement or attic or garage, whatever it was. And he's saved up some stuff. He's got boxes of memorabilia from his career. And he's looking and he finds a box that has his old Unabom gear from Smoky Mountain, which I think he also wore that same gear in Puerto Rico when he was playing a different character. It's the character he played right before he came to WWE as Isaac Yankem. And it's the same Unabom mask and gear that he wore for the very first match he ever had against The Undertaker. It's the match that got him noticed. It's the match that it was good enough that when Undertaker went back to WWE, you know, after doing the match, he said, you gotta sign this guy. This is a guy that I can work with. So he actually had the one and only Unabom outfit, which again, he sold. He did agree to sell that to back to WWE. He found an original Kane mask, tried it on and everything. And the thing was, they weren't sure if it was the original Kane mask from when he debuted at Bad Blood. So they have this one scene where the guys back at the warehouse, they're analyzing it. They're studying it. They're studying the patterns of the stripes on the mask and the stitching. And they determined that it was, in fact, not the original mask. It was likely mask number 2 that he would have used probably sometime early in 98. And so that got sold to WWE. Then there's the Paul Bearer Betrayal Urn, the urn that Paul Bearer used to turn on The Undertaker at SummerSlam in 1996. When he aligned with Mankind, he whacked Undertaker in the head with the urn. That was the Boiler Room Brawl. Paul Bearer, many years ago, he gifted that urn. They were trying to find, where is this urn? And it turns out he gifted the urn to a funeral director who I guess had written him a fan letter many years earlier. And Paul just showed up at the guy's funeral home one day with this urn in a velvet bag. He goes, here, I got a gift for you. And it's been sitting in the National Museum of Funeral History in Houston, Texas for all these years. Just like in a glass case with some other memorabilia that they have, non-wrestling memorabilia. So they find it. And Undertaker is shocked because he goes, look, I lived in Houston my whole life practically. I never even knew this place existed. And they go to the funeral museum, and the guy is very, you could tell he's very hesitant to give it up. He goes, well, we'll have to have a conversation with the director of the museum. It's not really my decision to make. So they meet with this woman, and you know, clearly this urn is very important to this guy. But I'm watching this going, here's Undertaker after this career that he has had. He is sitting in the middle of this funeral museum, you know, in this negotiating session, negotiating over a random urn that he got bonked in the head with, you know, 25 years ago. I don't know, just the ridiculousness of the entire, like, he gives a shit. I mean, come on. Please. But they convinced them, and so they got the betrayal urn, and the coolest thing was Undertaker decided, okay, I'm going to go through my storage unit, see what else I can find in there for you. And he's going through these bins in his storage unit, and he finds, he didn't even know it was in there. He finds the Phantom of the Opera mask that was custom made for him at the end of 95, after Mabel had fractured his orbital socket. He came back probably earlier than he should have, and they had this mask custom made to protect his face for a few months. He didn't wear it for very long. He had the mask the entire time, didn't even know it was there. So he agreed to donate that to WWE, and he found a box with the purple Undertaker gear that he debuted at SummerSlam in 94. Purple Undertaker, and he had him, AJ had him tried on, and Undertaker said, well, this may hang off on me a little bit. I used to be a little bit heavier than I am now, and he tried on the old Undertaker purple gear, which, again, I think he also donated to them. So tonight is, I guess, Jerry Lawler is going to be in the episode tonight. I enjoy it. I think it's, you know, like a fun little show. And all of this, I think, is just building to an eventual WWE brick and mortar Hall of Fame. You know, Triple H has talked about this just recently. Vince McMahon is not sold on there being a Hall of Fame. He says Vince McMahon just doesn't think Hall of Fames make money. And he may be right. It could be one of those things where, you know, there's only so many wrestling fans. When you go to the Hall of Fame, like if you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right? Or you go to the NHL, the Hockey Hall of Fame, which I've been to. I'm not even a big hockey fan. I've been to the Hockey Hall of Fame when I was in, I was on a trip to Toronto many years ago. How many times are you going to go back to that place when you've already gone there once? I don't care how big of a fan you are. I've been to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. I've been there twice. I didn't have any interest in going back after the first time. Not because I didn't like it, but it was like, I saw everything there was to see. I only went a second time because it was like a family trip. Once you go to these places once, you are very unlikely, I think, to go back. Unless you build a Hall of Fame within a building that you can have and host other events. Whether it's matches, signings, Q&As, I mean, whatever it might be. It would have to be like a big complex that's just more than a museum. So I don't even think Vince McMahon is wrong. I can understand where he's coming from. He looks at it as a money loser. As a fan, they've got to have a physical Hall of Fame at some point. I think Triple H is dying to do it. I think there's going to be one in what he's doing in the meantime, because Vince doesn't give a fuck about any of this stuff. This is Triple H. I do believe that he does care about this stuff. He's been collecting robes and old belts and stuff for years now. He collected stuff from Flair and Bruno, I think Harley Race, with the idea that one day he'll be able to share this more than just once a year at Fan Access. So I do think there'll be a Hall of Fame building one day. It just might not be while Vince McMahon is in charge and among the living. But I do think that is what this is building to. Now, speaking of shows on, not on Vice, or I'm sorry, not on A&E, but on Vice, Dark Side of the Ring, Season 3, premieres this Thursday on Vice TV. So you know what that means. The reviews are coming back to the podcast. I know you guys enjoyed the ones I did for the first two seasons. That is either going to be on Sound Off 703 next week, or if I don't have enough time to fit it in with the history stuff, which I probably won't, I might just post them directly to the YouTube channel. So wherever they land, I will be doing reviews for each episode of Dark Side of the Ring. The first one this week, it's a two-parter, two-hour episode on the life of Brian Pillman. Part one is already up. I am not watching it. I want to watch the whole thing in full on Thursday. But if you want to watch part one, the first 45 minutes are already up for free on the Vice TV YouTube channel and on their website for the Pillman episode. So it should be good. I'm looking forward to it. Let's talk about Raw and SmackDown. Braun Strowman is going to WrestleMania. Backlash. He has been inserted into the WWE title match between Drew McIntyre and Bobby Lashley, making it a triple threat with a win on this show this past Monday over McIntyre in the main event. So that's how Lashley keeps his title. You know, I was wondering, how does Lashley leave with the championship at Backlash? Because, you know, after such a clean win over Drew at WrestleMania, surely they would not have him go over so strongly a second time. So they might actually put the belt back on Drew, and then they go and they add Strowman, who can now take the losing fall. So that pretty much answers my question there. Got to keep that belt on Bobby, you know, either for a Daniel Bryan match if Bryan goes to Raw, which I think he will, or an eventual Brock Lesnar match, because if Brock comes back, you know he's not coming out of hibernation for anything other than to challenge for the championship. What would be the point of bringing him back for anything else if he's not going to go, you know, challenge for the title again? Why would he even bother coming, even just from a storyline perspective, why would he even bother coming back? Whether it was him against Lashley or him coming to go after Roman Reigns, right? Because of the connection with Paul Heyman, Roman is the other champion. So either way, you know, if Brock comes back, he's going to be challenging for a title. But whatever they choose to do, you got to keep the belt on Bobby for a little while longer. This was a Raw show on Monday in a long line of dreadfully boring Raw shows where it just feels like nothing of any great importance happens. But I am in a good mood today. There were a couple of beams of light on this show. They did at one point go nearly a full hour. They pulled a Kevin Nash from Nitro back in 2000. They went almost an hour without any wrestling whatsoever. And look, I am not a wrestling snob. I'm not asking for an hour of just straight wrestling with no story or promo work, because that's boring. But you cannot go an hour on a wrestling show with no wrestling. Not on this show, you can't. If it was a show that actually had compelling stories and characters and promos, then maybe you can get away with that. Not on Monday Night Raw, you can't. There's got to be action. Mace and T-Bar, they got a count-out win over McIntyre and Strowman at the beginning of the show. The name Mace is fine. T-Bar has got to go. I'm fine with keeping Mace as Mace. T-Bar, though, has got to go. I wouldn't even bother with the Dijakovic name that he used in NXT because it's too friggin' long. Call him Storm or something. Mace and Storm. I'm not opposed to having a cool name like, you know, you used to have Hawk and Animal, Axe and Smash, Hercules. But come up with something cool. If it's not Storm, I'm sure you can come up with something better. I'd keep them together as a tag team because they need more teams. Even with them as a team, they don't have enough teams. But they're better together for the time being than they would be apart. They had face paint on, a little bit of face paint on this week. It was giving me Ascension vibes, which would not be good for either of their careers. But when Strowman realized that Drew didn't make it back into the ring in time and he got counted out, Strowman got into the ring and he gave him what Adnan Virk shouted was the running power slam. Even though there was no running involved, he just picked him up and power slammed him. That would be like calling an Undertaker match when he picks the guy up for his finish and calling it a running tombstone. Strowman then went to Adam Pearce and said that he wanted a match with McIntyre later in the night, which is how they set that match up. Charlotte Flair was suspended indefinitely the week before and fined $100,000 for assaulting a WWE referee. That's where the whole story came from, about her having dental work done, which is true. That wasn't a Meltzer story. That was, I think it was Gary, was it Gary Cassidy or might have been someone else. I forgot exactly which website broke that story, but they got a quote, I think, directly from Charlotte herself. I think the issue with Meltzer was more in how he phrased it. So I don't know if she's already had the dental work done or not. I don't care. But the point is that suspension lasted all of 1 week. As Sonya Deville showed up and smuggled Charlotte in through the back door to the ring for a promo, where Charlotte apologized to the referee that she assaulted last week, Eddie Orengo. Deville said that she thought Adam Pearce's punishment was a little too harsh. He fined her, again, the $100,000 and suspended her. She's paid her fine, and now she is back. Adam Pearce was waiting for them at the gorilla position when they came back through. He was not happy. But he also didn't do anything about it. He just stormed off. Is he not Sonya's superior? Does she not work for him? Why not just veto the whole thing and send Charlotte back home if he's so upset? See, I think to get back at Charlotte, Adam Pearce should make Dave Meltzer the guest referee for all of her matches. And if she lays a finger on Dave, she is forced to stand in the middle of the locker room and read the latest copy of The Observer out loud. All 35,000 words of it. Sheamus was back out for his non-title open challenge after making short work of Humberto Carrillo the week before. Carrillo came back out again, and Sheamus mocked him, and then he cheap-shotted him, and Carrillo fought back. He hit a great-looking suicide dive that sent Sheamus over the announce desk. This was like one of those Darby Allin-type suicide dives that actually looks devastating to the person to whom is on the receiving end. This was not one of those standard dives that look like everyone else's. So this looked good, and Sheamus was pissed, and he was embarrassed, and I like this. I like that Carrillo didn't just take what happened to him the week before. He fought back. I mean, physically, he looks great. He transformed his body from the last time he was featured in any kind of real storyline on Raw, which goes back to when Paul Heyman was advocating for him and had influence behind the scenes on that show. He was a fan of Carrillo. That's why he started getting a push. So they're building him for a title match, a U.S. title match with Sheamus, and I'm down with that. Sheamus needs challengers, and this could be a good role for him to play, so I actually like this. After Matt Riddle's shock pin on Randy Orton the week before, Orton confronted him in the back, and he said he didn't know what planet Riddle was from. He interrupted Orton and said, Earth. Orton said they have nothing in common, and Riddle corrected him and pointed out that both of them are from Earth. Orton said Riddle had earned some respect from him with that win, and he said, about that RK-Bro tag team idea that you pitched last week, it's kind of catchy. And he said he took it upon himself to get a tag team match. If Riddle was down for the idea, they could be partners. And of course, Riddle was totally down because he's an idiot and the only person in the world who can't see that Randy Orton is just waiting to drop the hammer on him. They wrestled the new job squad of Cedric Alexander and Shelton Benjamin, and they won. Orton did not drop him, not yet. Instead, he just walked to the back. He looked pleased when the match was over. We know how this ends, but I will say, the RK-Bro thing has potential. It has the potential to turn into something entertaining because Orton and Riddle are polar opposites. And that's what makes these unlikely pairings entertaining. You have the one wacky guy, and then you have the straight guy, the guy who's kind of a square, which is Orton. I mean, I find Riddle's character unbelievably irritating. But I do want to see where this goes. I do want to give this a chance. They paired Rhea Ripley off with Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler against Asuka, Naomi, and Lana. Apparently, the Thunderdome fans are being told by the producers to cheer Rhea like she is a babyface, because they tell people in the Thunderdome who to cheer for and who to boo. And my understanding is they're telling people to cheer for Rhea. Yet, here she is paired off with the heels. And so that doesn't make any sense. And watching Rhea in this ring have to pretend to struggle against Lana is a fucking insult. Exactly the kind of thing I do not want to see Rhea Ripley doing on the main roster. Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke, they pranked Nia and Shayna by coming out mid-match, splashing water on Baszler, and when Nia came over, she pretended to slip on the water on the ground, and she was flopping around like a fish. This is horrendous television. The women's divisions on Raw and SmackDown right now, really outside of whatever they might be doing soon with Sasha and Bianca, once Bianca gets past Bayley, is in the toilet right now. I don't know what is going on with the writing for these women on both of these shows, especially on this show. This is the same company giving us that stacked division on NXT. Never has there been as much of a disconnect between the main roster and NXT with the ladies as there is right now. It is awful. These people don't have a fucking clue what they are doing. And then we have Mick Foley. This is as good a place as any to bring this up and talk about this. Because you know I was going to have something to say about this. I tweeted about it as soon as he put something on Twitter. Mick Foley was on Twitter tagging Vince McMahon. As if Vince McMahon actually tweets himself or even checks his replies. I wouldn't even be surprised to find out that he doesn't have the fucking app on his phone. Tagging Vince McMahon to tell him that an all-women's brand needs to happen. Unless, he says, McMahon wants AEW to beat him to the punch. Now, I can appreciate that Mick Foley is a fan. He once took a baseball bat to his television in protest of the way the WWE was treating Daniel Bryan and leaving Daniel Bryan out of the Royal Rumble match in 2014. Now he has decided to take up the mantle for the women in WWE. Does Mick Foley not watch Raw and SmackDown? It's an honest question. Because if he's a fan, I would imagine he's watching these shows from week to week. I ask this because if he did, an all-women's brand is the last thing that he would be asking for. Now, if it were an all-women's brand run exclusively as an NXT property, I would at least have some faith that they might get it right. They've got a stacked division down there. They've got lots of talented women over in NXT UK as well. I just watched the match this week between Mako Satomura and Aoife Valkyrie. And shout out to Jordan. He suggested I check it out because he knows I don't watch NXT UK every week. And I'm glad I did, because it was a really good match. But Foley didn't say a word about NXT. He was talking about it as a brand, I'm sure, for the women that we see on USA and on Fox every single week. Raw and SmackDown. How in God's name can you ask for WWE to produce an all-women's brand when you know it would be run by the same people responsible for producing these women's segments that we get every Monday and every Friday night? If these people started writing a women's only show, it would be a fucking disaster. And I don't want to hear, well, they can just put all new writers on the show. They're not going to put all new writers on the show. That's the point. I'm coming at this from a practical point of view, not from Candyland. This is all because Mickie James went on a podcast. She went on the Grown Ass Women podcast. And she talked about someone in WWE. She didn't name names. But she pitched this very idea to them for an all-women's brand. She said, I would help lead it. And she'd have this whole team of women behind her. And this person said to her, they, being WWE, are never going to do it. Ever. Women's wrestling doesn't really make money. The Women's Evolution pay-per-view was the lowest rated pay-per-view ever in WWE history. I get what you're trying to do, but you're better off trying to figure out a way to get the women incorporated into better spots on the existing shows. Okay, that's what she says this person said to her. First of all, I don't know who this person was, but whoever they are, they're a fucking idiot. The Evolution show was not the least purchased pay-per-view or least successful pay-per-view in WWE history. And with the network, how do you even determine anymore what a good pay-per-view buy rate even is? They had Ronda Rousey on their roster as an active wrestler. Ronda Rousey was at one time a box office attraction on pay-per-view as a mixed martial artist. So her wrestling matches, okay, they might not do the same kind of business that her fights did. A big WWE pay-per-view might not do what a big UFC pay-per-view was going to do. But she's still an attraction that you can keep special and you can make a lot of money with. And I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did make a lot of money with Ronda Rousey. Becky Lynch organically became the hottest star in the company. And credit to the company as well, because I say organically, I don't think the company ever expected the people to get behind her in the way that they did, just like they never expected Daniel Bryan to get over at the level that he did. But to give the company credit, the reason it worked out that way with Becky is because they liked her, number one, but she was on a losing streak. She was losing for so long. They were doing nothing with her. She was like, they talked about the horsewomen. She was the lost horsewomen. It was Charlotte. It was Sasha that people looked at as the big stars, as the big names, the big breakout names from that group. But then Becky started to win, and she started to win some more, and she started to win a little bit more. When Charlotte was away, she came back and was instantly inserted into the title picture. The fans felt cheated. They felt like, that's not fair. This is Becky Shaw. Why is Charlotte being shoehorned into this? Which, by the way, is the story of her career. Charlotte being shoehorned into programs and matches that she has no business being in. That wasn't the first time, or if it was, it certainly wasn't the last time that would happen, as we know. So it took, you know, the booking played a role in Becky getting over the way that she did, but she became a huge name. She became the hottest star in the company. I don't just mean the hottest female star. I mean the hottest star for a while there in the entire company. So we know that it can be done. It is not impossible. You just need the right mix of talent. You need some sensible booking, and you need a little bit of luck. You need people back in the building is what you need. That's got to be an ingredient too. And hopefully that'll be coming in the next few months. Can you imagine Becky Lynch if that whole scenario played out that year in 2018, I think it was, right? The way that it played out, playing out in a pandemic year with no people in the audience. Becky Lynch doesn't get over the way that she did. So you need people back too. But, you know, one or two of them, you can have one or two people catch fire maybe the way that Becky did, and they can lead the charge. The one thing that person said to Mickey that I do agree with is that you would be better served to try to get them to do a better job with the ladies on your existing show. Strengthen them enough to where in 6 months or a year, maybe then it would make sense to do an all-women show. I do think they should have a majority female team writing for the women. That would make more sense than having a bunch of old dudes sitting around writing for them. These people can barely write for the men. You think they're going to write good television for the women? I give you Exhibit A, Monday Night Raw. Case closed. So get some women in there who actually can relate to these ladies and can write stories that make sense that people can get into for them. I don't know what the current makeup is right now of their writing team. I know they've had female writers before. I don't know how many they have now. I don't know if they're the ones writing for the women or not. Probably not. But how about addressing the issues on Raw and SmackDown first and getting your own house in order before you go and build a new one? They have 3 hours of television every Monday night. They barely can figure out how to fill those hours. Got plenty of time on that show to put together two or three coherent storylines for the ladies that don't involve bad comedy. And then you can do the same thing on SmackDown. But I don't know, I don't understand how anybody can watch these shows every Monday and think, hey, you know what this company needs right now? Another show. Yes, because 205 Live has done so much to grow interest in their cruiserweight division. It's been such a big priority for them. The last thing WWE needs right now is a women's only show that they don't even want to do in the first place. So they half-ass it, and when it fails, they can turn around and say, see, we told you. We told you women's wrestling doesn't draw. The reason they did an all-women's pay-per-view was because they could put Ronda Rousey in the main event. That's why they did it. That and all the bad PR they were getting for keeping the women behind for their Saudi Arabia shows. The timing was perfect. This was like their make-good to the women. We'll give you your own pay-per-view. That'll shut everybody up. But the minute Ronda went away, so too did any chance of them even considering an Evolution 2, because they have no faith in their own women to carry the show. They won't even do an Evolution 2. And Mick Foley thinks that they're going to devote their resources to an entire brand? You know, Foley was just on that new WWE show I talked about on A&E, searching for his original Mr. Socko. He should have been searching for his brain for him to even suggest such a thing. Alexa Bliss is still swinging and talking to her puppet friend, but it sounds like she's finally about to rejoin the ranks of the Raw Women's Division. She said her friend Lily was getting restless just playing with her. She wants everybody to know whatever happens, Lily made her do it. I still can't believe, after feuding for 6 months on television and The Fiend being burned alive, he makes his big comeback, the big payoff to the Fiend-Randy Orton feud was a Randy Orton win at WrestleMania due to distraction by Alexa Bliss. That was it. That is really how they ended things. Now that we've had some distance from WrestleMania, we see that they're moving in a totally different direction with these people, storyline-wise. That is really how they ended things. Which just goes to show you, you know, long-term storytelling, we talk about how, oh, there should be more long-term storytelling in wrestling, and there should be. But long-term storytelling in and of itself is not good because it's long-term. That's not what makes it good. It's good because it leads somewhere and it makes sense. Otherwise, you can have a year-long storyline. If it doesn't pay off in a good way or lead somewhere good, then it's shit. And that's what that storyline was. It was shit. Doesn't help that Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard supposedly changed the finish at the last minute that weekend from a Fiend win to a Fiend loss. So when you read about a last-minute decision being made for a six-month-long feud, this is what you end up with. And Braun is going to Backlash, as I mentioned. That's your Raw report. Let's talk about SmackDown. Daniel Bryan is now banished from the blue brand. It is a good thing they also have a red brand and a yellow brand. And I expect him to show up on one or both of them in the next few months. Daniel Bryan and Roman Reigns had the best WWE television match of the year so far on Friday night. Nearly 30 minutes long through three commercial breaks. And per the stipulation, Bryan is now gone from SmackDown. Now, I was also told that Charlotte Flair was suspended, and then she was back a week later. So while I do believe that Bryan is gone from SmackDown, I can't say that I would be completely shocked if they found some kind of loophole and got him back on the show this week. Bianca Belair tagged with the Street Profits in a win over Dolph Ziggler, Bobby Roode, and Bayley. Montez Ford got the pin on Roode, which keeps the Street Profits right in the mix for the tag team titles. But we also had a backstage promo with Rey and Dominic, openly talking about becoming the first ever father and son duo to hold the titles. And you can guarantee that that is going to happen. Natty and Tamina beat Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler, with Baszler once again eating the pin. This woman is awfully hungry. She's been eating a lot lately, eating a lot of these pins. I hope they're fat-free. Low sodium. Maybe they're vegan. Vegan pins. The women's tag team champions, they've lost so many matches at this point. It will not mean much when they finally drop the belts, whoever they drop them to, whether it's Tamina and Natty, which, ugh, or someone else. Tamina also needs to find another finish, because clearly with her knees, that Superfly Splash looks awful. You know, her father was hitting that move better at 63 than she's hitting it at 43. So I think it would be better for her to find something a little more low impact, a little lower to the ground. You know, they gave the Commander Aziz guy with Big E, they gave him the Nigerian nail, right? The old Samoan spike. That would have been a good move for Tamina. We had another very dark vignette from Aleister Black in his Tales of the Father book. We had more animation, this time about a boy in high school and his dreams of the perfect prom date and going to college and buying a 3-bedroom house with a white picket fence. How his father taught him about all of that, all that was wrong with that. He could give all of us the keys to escape, but he won't. All right, then. We got another cheap finish to the Big E Apollo Crews rematch for the Intercontinental title, with Commander Aziz pulling Big E out of the ring after he had the match won with the big ending and shoving Big E into the ring post. Kevin Owens ran out to make the save after. Sami Zayn came from out of nowhere. He wiped out Owens with a haluva kick, picked up the Intercontinental title, and then was trying to calm down Apollo and Aziz and said, "Oh, easy there. I'm just handing it to you. I'm handing you the belt. I'm going to raise your hand." And he ate a Nigerian nail for his efforts. Apollo looks great with that title. I like the way that he's just completely transformed himself. I'm happy to see him getting a sustained push. One of the nice little success stories right now going on SmackDown. They announced a throwback edition of SmackDown for this Friday, and they showed the original SmackDown logo. I don't know if it's just a show with retro SmackDown elements or if they're just doing another version of old school Raw. But they're doing it on a Friday this time instead of a Monday night. They'll probably just trot out the legends for, you know, bad comedy like they always do. All I want is the original SmackDown theme, which had no words. It was just, that was the whole song. Bring back the original SmackDown theme and the fist. Bring back the fist entrance. I know it's not part of their HD set, but it can't be that hard to put a fist on top of it. Or even the Ovaltron. I will settle for the Ovaltron, even though that's not, I know that's not HD LED either, but I would love to see either one of those elements brought back for one night. We're also getting a WrestleMania rematch between Seth Rollins and Cesaro. I thought they did a great job of building up the main event on this show, like a big match. They had cut-ins all throughout the night to various people offering their predictions for the championship match. Rollins, Cesaro, Nakamura, Baron Corbin, The Miz, Kofi and Xavier, Booker T offered his thoughts. Pat McAfee, I think, has settled in very nicely in just the first 2 or 3 weeks at the announce desk. I love when he gets very excited. You could see him standing in the background, standing up. He even got Michael Cole to stand up for part of that main event with him. Roman Reigns had revealed months ago that they were working on new theme music for him. He's been using that Shield theme now for almost a decade, so it was long past due for him to get new music. He had told Bleacher Report, and shout out to Graham, I think he was the one who did the interview, but he had told Bleacher Report that he wanted to make sure it was perfect for his character. This is what he said at that time. This is months ago. He said, "With this character, it has to be the right vibe. We can't just hire a rapper and check out this guitar riff. It can't be some rock music. The Shield music, I wasn't even really into it back in the day, but over the years, it just started working. You get so used to it that I just time my pace to it. But yes, it takes some time and it has to be right." Well, that time came on Friday night, which is a little strange they didn't unveil the music at WrestleMania. I mean, you would think at WrestleMania, big entrance, right? New theme music, that'd be the perfect place to debut it. And instead they waited until, you know, 3 weeks after WrestleMania. But they unveiled it here. It is a totally different vibe from the Shield music. Honestly, it reminds me a little bit of the Seth Rollins Messiah theme. But I like this much better than I like that. I think it'll take a little getting used to after hearing the same song for so long. But to me, it has kind of a cinematic, epic feel to it. Like something out of a movie scene. But for a heel, it's very heelish. Got a very heelish vibe to it, so it fits. This is not a song I think that would work nearly as well for a babyface. So for all you people who are still, and I don't know if there are any people left who are actually thinking this, but I know a few months after Roman came back, there were still people arguing with me that, oh, he's not really a heel. He's not a heel yet. Or he's a tweener. Well, now he's got heel music So he is officially a heel now. There can be no debate. I know I got one email from Anthony. Anthony emailed me and said it sounded like Stardust was back. I wouldn't say that. Look, I'm just happy the guy has new music. For years, people clamored. They wanted Roman to change his look, change his attitude, go heel, change your music. Stop living in the past. Stop being the Shield. Now we've got all three. And what the guy is doing is working. No one on either brand right now can touch the work that Roman Reigns is doing right now. Which is why he needs to hold on to that Universal title for a long time. He and Brian had an excellent match. Better than their Fastlane match from 6 years ago. Although it has been years since I've seen that match. Maybe if I were to watch it back, I'd feel differently. But I think it was better than that. You know, in the end, there was no Edge. There was no Jey Uso. There was no Cesaro. At least not until after the bell. So if anything surprised me, it was how clean of a win it was. He put Brian out with the guillotine choke. It's like Lashley putting McIntyre out with the Hurt Lock at WrestleMania. That surprised me. They have been putting their heel champions over in dominant fashion. All the male singles champions are heels in this company right now, not counting the 24/7 joke belt, right? Lashley, Reigns, Sheamus, and Apollo. Then you throw in Kenny Omega in AEW and Impact, and Will Ospreay in New Japan, Drake Wirtz in NXT, and it's a good time to be a heel in wrestling right now. Edge not showing up was a surprise. I fully expected, you know, we haven't seen him in almost a month. And if anybody has a right in storyline to be bitter about Daniel Bryan coming back and wanting a title shot and getting another title match, it would be Edge. So, you know, pleasantly surprised he didn't run in for the finish and cause a DQ or a distraction or something like that. Reigns grabbed two chairs to use on Bryan after the match for the concerto, which may be a sign that when Edge does come back, he's coming back after Roman, if Roman starts using that concerto on a regular basis. Cesaro ran out before he could smash Bryan's head. He was laying in those uppercuts before Jey Uso attacked. They tied Cesaro up in the ropes. They forced him to watch as Roman gave Bryan a concerto. Good heel shit right here. Make the man watch. So Bryan is banished. As I said last week, he's trying to work out a deal where he stays with the WWE, but they allow him to work matches in other promotions in Japan, and I want $1 million and a hot tub time machine, but there are just certain things in life that are never going to happen. I think he takes some time off. Maybe he shows up on the Raw brand a little bit closer to SummerSlam if they want to do Lashley and Bryan at SummerSlam before Bryan's contract expires in the fall. Maybe he does some matches on NXT. That could be fun too. But if that was Daniel Bryan's swan song on SmackDown, he could not have gone out with a better match. A few weeks ago, I asked all my Irish listeners, I've got quite a few of them actually from that part of the world, and I asked them whether it was realistic to think that WWE would be running the 3 Arena in Dublin for the NXT UK TakeOver show that had been rescheduled for June. And I was asking, you know, how are things going on the COVID front over there? And you made it very clear there was no chance that the show was going to happen. Well, now WWE and Ticketmaster have made it official. NXT UK TakeOver Dublin has been canceled. Not postponed, it has been canceled. Gary Cassidy got this quote directly from WWE. NXT UK Live Dublin, scheduled to take place at the 3 Arena on Sunday, June 20th, has been canceled. Refunds will be available from the point of purchase. So Walter and Finn Balor, I guess, will have to wait for another time. Some highlights from NXT this week, or at least the stuff that stood out to me. Mercedes Martinez opened the show. She had a match against Dakota Kai that I was enjoying. Ended in a disqualification when Raquel Gonzalez, who was outside the ring, she ran in and she beat up Mercedes Martinez, and she was throwing her around outside the ring, and I think she lawn darted her into the protective screens, the barriers there. So that's setting her up for, you know, her championship match with Raquel. You know, Raquel has been kind of all smiles, and she was almost like a babyface on television, you know, the last few weeks, and this was the polar opposite. So if you were wondering what is she? You know, her and Dakota, are they babyfaces? Are they heels? At least this week, they were very much heels. They did a couple of vignettes, or at least one, and they cut it into two parts with Cameron Grimes, who was doing a takeoff on the old Ted DiBiase skits. When Ted DiBiase went to the jewelry shop in Connecticut many years ago to have his $1 million championship made, here, Cameron Grimes walked into a jewelry store. He was looking to buy a nice gift for himself, and he was looking for a watch. And he found a gold watch that he liked, and he was going to buy it. He was going to flaunt his money around and buy the gold watch. All of a sudden, somebody shows up behind him with a watch of their own and says, "That's a nice watch, but it's no $1 million watch." And the camera pans back, and we see that it's the $1 million man who has been tormenting Cameron Grimes for weeks now. Or at least the, I mean, he really hasn't been doing anything to him. It's more the kind of the legend of Ted DiBiase. It's been bothering Cameron Grimes. He's been haunted by the almost like the ghost of Ted DiBiase. Well, Ted DiBiase showed up this week, and he did the cackle, his evil laugh, as he walked out of the shop. So I don't know if that's just one and done. I don't know if he's going to do more stuff with Cameron Grimes or what. This was fine for what it was. I don't know what the status of DiBiase's legal troubles are. If you remember that whole story, I think that's still kind of hanging over his head. The Isaiah Scott stuff, Isaiah Swerve Scott, I wanted to mention this, has been really good. I've been digging these pre-taped vignettes they've been doing with him from the recording studio because, you know, he does music as well. So it's a play off his real self. And instead of just doing like a backstage vignette or him standing in the ring with a mic in his hand, they've been doing these interview segments where he'll be sitting in like the producer's chair in front of his, all of his equipment and everything, the soundboard. And the way that these are shot and the promo work in them has been really good. And this was no exception. We got another one of them on the show this week. He was talking about Leon Ruff. And he basically proposed a Falls Count Anywhere match, which is going to happen this Tuesday on NXT. Falls Count Anywhere to end this once and for all between himself and Leon Ruff. And I just thought this was really well done. He comes off very well in these segments. We had Zeta Ramir, who was trained by Booker T. She is a Reality of Wrestling alum. Shout out to ROW. Zeta got an upset win over Toni Storm off of a distraction from Zoe Stark, who walked down to the ring in the middle of the match, and she didn't do anything. She didn't get physical or anything, but it distracted Toni Storm enough where she ended up getting knocked down, and Ramir hit a shooting star press for the win. A little bit scary. It looked like Toni may have been a little too far away, but Ramir nailed it. Storm now has lost to Zoe Stark, who's still a relative newcomer to the roster. She's now lost to Ramir in, I think, really her first singles match on NXT. I would prefer that Toni Storm not become the stepping stone for other people. So my hope is that she comes out of the Zoe Stark match or the Zoe Stark feud that they have with a win and starts to rack up some more wins after that. Got to rack up some momentum because right now she has none. And it's very strange. You know, they turned her heel because she was over as a babyface, and they turned her heel, and now she's just losing all the time. So I'm hoping she has a reversal of fortune soon. Bronson Reed, he's doing pretty well for himself. He's continuing to rack up wins. He got a win here over Austin Theory, which now sets up Bronson Reed for a North American Championship match with Johnny Gargano. He won the match with the big tsunami splash, which looks great. You know, again, he comes down. It looks like hard impact on the way down. He gets the pin. There was some gaga going on during the match with Dexter Lumis coming down, and Indy Hartwell didn't want to talk to him at first. And, you know, it's fine. You know, it's something for... I enjoy the subtle comedic stuff that Indy Hartwell does. She's kind of the, like, the silent member almost of the way of that little group. But I enjoy the stuff that she does. Where the thing with Loomis is going, I don't know. Again, I probably will end up with him talking. Be like when Kane talked for the first time, they put the voice box up to him, he says, "Sock it!" I don't think that's what Dexter Loomis is going to... Well, actually, Dexter Loomis might say that if he likes Indy Hartwell. But that's... anyway, that's neither here nor there. We'll see where that... we'll see where that... I set myself up for that one. I didn't intend for that. But it's true, though. Those were Kane's first words on television. He said, "Suck it," right? I don't know that that would be appropriate for... for Dexter Loomis. I mean, that might be what he wants to say, but it might not be appropriate for USA. So we had Adam Cole. Adam Cole was being interviewed poolside by Arash Markazi. Is it Markazi or Marchese? I think it might be Marchese. He's got his own podcast, his own show. Now he's working for WWE, I guess, as an interviewer. So this was his first big sit-down interview, and he got it with Cole, and Cole was talking about Kyle O'Reilly. As people are talking about Kyle as being the face of NXT, Kyle O'Reilly will never be the face of anything. I like Kyle. Kyle's a great wrestler. Kyle is not the face of a brand. So I don't care if it's a small brand like NXT or something like Raw and SmackDown. I wish him luck. I think he can definitely find success, but Kyle O'Reilly will never be the face of anything. And Adam Cole basically said as much and said he's not ready for the main event. He says, as long as I'm in NXT, Kyle can, he can't have that spot. And then he asked Cole for his thoughts on Karrion Kross, and Cole said he's good, but he's not sure if Kross is quite great. He goes, you know, the injury that he had, even though it was a freak accident, it could be an example that Karrion Kross is simply not ready to be champion. And he talked about Kyle O'Reilly a little bit more, and see you soon, so I... The one good thing is, it sounds like Adam Cole is not going anywhere. Adam Cole is staying put in NXT for his career. If you are an Adam Cole fan, you should be rejoicing, dancing in the street. Because going to the main roster would be the absolute worst possible outcome right now for this man. Even though I don't know what's really left for him to do in NXT, it really is the best place for him to be. And the main event was Legado del Fantasma getting a win over the Cruiserweight champion Kushida and MSK, the reigning NXT Tag Team Champions, or as they said in a backstage segment earlier in the night, MS Kushida. So the heels went over here, as they had to set up future matches. Escobar powerbombed Kushida through the announce desk in the middle of this match. That left Wes Lee, who got shoved off the top rope, and Nash Carter went to go check on Kushida. He got booted in the face and sent into the ring steps. So Lee was all by himself alone in the ring for a while against all three of the heels. He was able to come back, and he made a tag eventually to Carter, but in the end they fell to the heels. So Legado del Fantasma goes over. That was your main event, kind of a different spot to put the Cruiserweight title and the Cruiserweight spot on display in the main event. I don't know that that's really happened before. Two matches so far announced for NXT this Tuesday. Street Fight for the NXT Tag Team Championships. Ember Moon and Shotzi Blackheart defend against Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell. And Falls Count Anywhere. Leon Ruff one-on-one against Isaiah Swerve Scott. They also had some Instagram footage they put, or Instagram photos, that they aired on the show of Finn Balor with his wife. I guess they were vacationing. He seems to be taking his championship loss very well. But he is going to be back on television this week. So, again, Finn Balor is another one who doesn't appear to be going anywhere for now. I thought maybe they would move him back up. I thought there was a much more likely chance of him being moved because he's already been on Raw and SmackDown before. And they could certainly use some more baby faces if they were to, let's say, put him on Raw and build him up to challenge Bobby Lashley, maybe, for the WWE title. If he did that, though, even if he was a babyface, my hope is that when the time comes, and it will come, that Finn Balor is called back down to the main roster, we don't get the smiley, jokey Finn Balor back, the one who used to do that, he'd stand, remember he did that weird stance. I don't know what the fuck that was. I much prefer the Finn Balor that we've had in NXT. The Finn Balor who's comes off a lot more heelish and doesn't take shit from anybody. He doesn't come out, he's not smiling about anything, and he just goes in there and he kicks people's asses. Heel or face, whichever he is. I hope that's the Finn Balor when the time comes I'd like to see when they call him back down. But right now, it looks like he's going to stay right where he is, and I'll say the same thing for him that I said for Adam Cole. That's a good thing. As DDP would say, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, a week where Vince McMahon once wrestled God himself, and where 10 years ago WWE launched its Be a Star anti-bullying campaign. If only they would have let CM Punk finish his thought before cutting him off during that pipe bomb promo. He was just about to get to the good stuff. 44 years ago this week, on April 30th, 1977, at the Baltimore Civic Center, superstar Billy Graham defeated Bruno Sammartino to win the WWWF Championship, ending Bruno's second and final run with the belt at 1,237 days, or roughly the length of a normal episode of Monday Night Raw. They chose Baltimore out of an abundance of caution. They were a little worried about what might happen if Bruno lost the belt in Madison Square Garden. This was the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Match of the Year for 1977. Graham won the title with his foot on the ropes for leverage. Ironically, he would lose the title the following year to Bob Backlund with his foot on the bottom rope, as Backlund pinned him. So, hey, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. But his loss wasn't a surprise to him, as Vince McMahon Sr., before he even won the title, told him the exact day that he would win it and the exact day that he would lose it. None of this booking week-to-week stuff that his son does. 30 years ago this week, on the April 27th, 1991 episode of WWF Superstars, in one of the more traumatic moments of my young wrestling fandom, it was Damien's demise. It all started a couple of weeks removed from WrestleMania 7. Jake had wrapped up his program, Jake the Snake that is, with the model Rick Martel. He comes to find out that the mighty Earthquake is deathly afraid of snakes, and so naturally he starts to scare him with Damien. 1 week later on Wrestling Challenge, Earthquake and Jimmy Hart drop by the barbershop. This was the very first installment of the barbershop with Brutus the Barber Beefcake. To talk about Jake, and Beefcake scares Earthquake with a rubber snake and he runs away. So now we come to the match. And it's not much of one. Jake brings Damien out of the bag. Earthquake takes off down the aisleway, but he's forced back down to the ring. And Jake is forced to put the snake bag underneath the ring. Earthquake attacks him, gets him inside, ties him up in the ropes. Not unlike what Jake would do months later to Randy Savage in another traumatic angle. Let me tell you something. Jake's stuff, especially that year, Jake's stuff really fucked me up as a kid. Jimmy Hart tackles Earl Hebner to the ground to hold him down, hence the disqualification. Earthquake slides the snake bag into the middle of the ring, and he forces Jake to watch as he hits the ropes and he sits down on the bag. He squashes Damien to death. Jake says the angle wasn't his idea, but they wanted him to be knocked out of the ring and not see what Earthquake did. It was his idea to get tied up in the ropes instead and be forced to watch his pet brutally murdered. And you know what? He was absolutely right. It works so much better that way. Now, if you watched the original airing like I did, you saw them cut away to Sean Mooney in the event center each time Earthquake sat down on the bag. They showed the uncensored version of this on Primetime Wrestling the following week. They freed Jake from the ropes, did the referees. He untied the bag to look inside, and he was devastated by what he saw. Now, of course, Damien was not actually inside the bag. Instead, it was 60 pounds of hamburger meat stuffed inside women's pantyhose. According to Bruce Pritchard, the idea was when Earthquake sat down on the bag, blood would ooze out, but that didn't happen. Instead, Earthquake ended up with a wet spot on his ass. There's a visual for you. On Primetime Wrestling, Earthquake was a guest, and he served the hosts what they thought were hamburgers hot off the grill. Or at least that's what they thought they were eating. That's what Vince McMahon and Lord Alfred Hayes thought. Bobby Heenan, he was chowing down on probably three or four burgers. He was laughing the whole time, talking about how you could eat them, or you can make a pair of shoes out of them. And they soon realized what they were eating was not hamburger meat, it was snake meat from Damien's dead carcass. Vince McMahon got angry. He smacked the tray full of burgers out of Earthquake's hands. Earthquake was hilarious, wearing his chef's hat. He's just eating burgers the whole time. He's got that big Chef Boyardee hat on. You know, you watch this, really you watch anything with Earthquake from this period, and it is hard to believe that he was only 27 years old when this was filmed, when this aired. He was 27, he would turn 28 a few months later. He didn't look a day over 40. But it was only a few months later that Jake turned heel, and I like to think that it was Damien's death that drove him to turn heel later that year. 26 years ago this week, on April 26, 1995, at a wrestling challenge taping in Moline, Illinois for a show to air that weekend, Triple H made his in-ring debut as Hunter Hearst Helmsley, the Greenwich Blue Blood, against convicted child molester Buck Zumhoff. He won not with a pedigree, but with an RKO. Although obviously they didn't call it that, they called it a cutter, which is what it is. For those who don't know, Zumhoff was jailed twice back in the 1980s for sexual misconduct with a minor, which apparently did not stop WWE from using him here, even after their own sex scandals involving minors. Zumhoff was arrested again in 2013. He was charged with 12 counts of criminal sexual misconduct for abusing his own daughter from 1999 to 2011. She was only 15 years old when the abuse began. The day that he was convicted, the dumb shit that he is, he tried to flee the courthouse, but he was tackled to the ground by court officers, and they tacked on even more charges. And he is currently serving 25 years. May he rot in there. 2 days later, on April 28th, and again on April 29th, 1995... gave us the largest crowds ever assembled for a professional wrestling show on back-to-back days in Pyongyang Stadium in the Hermit Kingdom of North Korea as part of the World Peace Festival. Allegedly 150,000 spectators on day one, 190,000 on day two. It's amazing how many people you can get in a stadium when you're forced to attend, with the penalty of death. Maybe Dave Meltzer can get us the actual attendance number. This was the joint WCW-New Japan Collision in Korea, which is getting its own Dark Side of the Ring episode this season, so I'm going to wait and go into more detail about this next month, but in their one and only match against each other, Antonio Inoki beat Ric Flair. Flair tells the story of how Scott Norton was on the phone. He was on that trip as well, and Scott was on the phone with his family. He was apparently telling them that he didn't really like being there, and all of a sudden, the call went dead. Flair said the surveillance there the entire time was very intimidating. The moment they landed, they split everybody up. They took all their passports away from them. They took them to different hotels. They assigned a person to watch over them the entire time they were there. When the event was over, they kept them for several more days, and they wanted Flair to make a public statement that after his time there, he now saw how North Korea could dominate the United States if they wanted to. And Flair said that he was just, he said that he was just thrilled and honored to be there. And I guess that was enough to satisfy them, and he went home. 25 years ago this week, on April 28th, 1996, WWE presented its Good Friends, Better Enemies in Your House pay-per-view from Omaha. This was the final pay-per-view for both Diesel and Razor Ramon, who were on their way to WCW. Razor lost to Vader, while Diesel had no problem putting over his buddy Shawn Michaels in a no-holds-barred match for the championship, his first title defense since beating Bret Hart at WrestleMania. They had shot an angle at a house show from Madison Square Garden the month before where Diesel who really was the earliest tweener, I think, that WWE ever had. From that period after he lost the belt to when he left, you know, he was the cool heel. He would only smack hands with fans that wore black diesel gloves in the audience. But there weren't really any people in the company who were sort of booked that way at that time. But he was still friends with Shawn Michaels, and so they teamed up at MSG 2 weeks before WrestleMania in a match against Bret Hart and The Undertaker, which they lost by disqualification when Diesel hit Undertaker with a chair. Then after the match was over, he hit Bret with the chair, and then he hit Shawn with the same chair right across the back. Judas. And when Michaels was helped to the back, he was heard saying, "I'm going to kick his 7-foot ass." So that would explain why, despite losing to The Undertaker at WrestleMania, Diesel was the one who got the title match here and not Undertaker, who instead wrestled Mankind in a dark match at the end of the night. This was the greatest match of Kevin Nash's career. I don't think he ever had a better match before or after this. I think it was better than any of the matches he had with Bret Hart, which would be his other greatest matches. So wouldn't you know, his best matches came against Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, two of the greatest workers in the history of the business. But it was a chance for the company to show that their new champion here was not just a pretty boy. He could take an ass-kicking in a hardcore match, and he can give it right back. You know, Diesel had promised a surprise for Vince McMahon at ringside. Vince was doing commentary with Jerry Lawler. And his big surprise was powerbombing Shawn Michaels through the announce desk right in front of Vince. Diesel then, in the ultimate heel act, he walked over to Mad Dog Vachon sitting in the front row. He grabbed Mad Dog out of his seat, took him to the ground in a very gentle way, and he ripped his prosthetic leg off to use as a weapon. Vachon had been involved in a hit-and-run accident one day while jogging, and he had to have his leg amputated, hence the artificial leg. Also on this show, the Ultimate Warrior challenged Goldust for the Intercontinental title in a horrible match that really wasn't much of one because Goldust was injured. A few weeks earlier at a show in Dusseldorf, Germany, match against Razor Ramon, he tore the MCL in his knee, and he had to fly home early from the tour to be evaluated by Dr. Andrews in Birmingham. They were hopeful that he could work a short match here, but he really couldn't do much. So what we got was a lot of stalling by Goldust and his new bodyguard, who didn't last long after this. He was played by Mantar. Not as Mantar, that would have been better, but by the man who played Mantar. The man who played the tar. Mike Halleck, I believe his name was. Who was given no name, he was just a guy. For the first time, this was the first time we saw him, he just walked out with Goldust that night. But he was there to take bumps, that was his job. He was there to take bumps that Goldust couldn't take. From the Warrior. Warrior grabbed Marlena's cigar. He began smoking it. He put on Goldust's wig. He burned Goldust's hand with the cigar. He clotheslined him out of Marlena's director's chair. Goldust bailed. He got counted out. Not even the great Mantar could save this. 23 years ago this week, on April 26, 1998, WWE drew what was then the largest attendance for a wrestling event in the history of the Greensboro Coliseum for its Unforgiven In Your House pay-per-view, the first to be promoted using the Attitude Era Scratch logo. The show gave us WWE's first ever evening gown match between two women with Sable and Luna Vachon, won by Luna, and the first ever Inferno match between Kane and The Undertaker, which was quite the spectacle to watch. Undertaker diving out over the top rope, over the flames, onto Kane and Vader outside the ring. Vader had run down. While Undertaker was off beating up Paul Bearer, the special effects folks were fitting Kane's arm at ringside with a protective sleeve for the big climactic spot where he got knocked backwards into the flames and his arm was set on fire. I mean, it looked ridiculous. Even watching it live, it looked ridiculously fake, but there's really no other safe way to do a spot like that. It's just funny, like, they cut back to ringside, and there's Kane with a fucking plastic bag on his arm. It's like, you know, again, there's no safe way, I guess, to do a spot like that, but I just wish it wasn't so obvious. And in his first title defense on pay-per-view, coming out of WrestleMania 14, Stone Cold Steve Austin lost to Dude Love via disqualification after striking a WWF official in a match where he also blasted Vince McMahon in the face with a steel chair outside the ring as McMahon was trying to help Dude Love to his feet. Was he trying to hit Dude or was he aiming for the owner? That was the question that Jim Ross was asking as the show ended. One of the all-time great Vince McMahon bumps here. Place went apeshit for that chair shot. You know, as much as fun as this match was, they would have an even better match the following month at the Over the Edge pay-per-view. And Vince McMahon would take an equally brutal chair shot. It was bad enough that he needed dental work after the show. It was such a hard shot, it knocked the caps right off his teeth. 22 years ago, on April 26th, 1999, on an episode of WCW Monday Nitro from Fargo, North Dakota, Sting defeated Diamond Dallas Page just before the start of Hour 2 of a 3-hour show to win the WCW World Heavyweight title in a match that I included in my list of the top 15 matches in WCW history of the Turner era. It was not a ranked list, but I included that match because it was that damn good. It was a really good match. And by the way, if you want to listen to my recap of that match and all the other matches, all other 14 matches in that countdown, I have a whole playlist up on the YouTube channel, so you can find all those clips there. But they placed the match at the end of Hour 1 as a way to try to keep some of the audience that would usually flip over to the start of Monday Night Raw, and it worked. They only lost about 200,000 viewers instead of the usual 1 or 2 million that would drop off around that time. DDP had won his first WCW World title only 2 weeks before this at Spring Stampede in a four-way against Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, and Sting, with Randy Savage as the guest referee, and then turned heel on Nitro the very next night. It sounded like they had 30,000 people in the building that night for this match, but it was only about 11,000. Just a fun match to watch, truly one of the very best matches in Nitro history. The people were jazzed to see Sting win the title, and there was still 2 hours left to go, which meant 2 hours left to screw it all up. Now, this happened right around the time Ric Flair was committed to a mental institution on television, not in real life, although sometimes I think he probably should have been committed to a mental institution for his own good. They sent Flair to the Funny Farm, which is where the people writing this show probably should have been sent. In Flair's absence, Charles Robinson, Lil Nate, was appointed vice president of WCW. Yes, the referee. Charles Robinson is now the VP of WCW. Now, mind you, Roddy Piper also thought he was in charge at that time. I don't remember the circumstances around why he thought that, but apparently he did. Flair somehow finds out about this, and he calls Lil Nate from the asylum to tell him that he's not happy about Piper wielding power, and he wants Robinson to call in the National Guard to deal with this problem. He says this while yelling at the other patients for touching his robe. Robinson subsequently has Piper arrested. He fires him from WCW. Kevin Nash then decides that he wants a four-way main event with himself, Goldberg, DDP, and Sting for the WCW title. Flair tells Lil Nate to make the match, which I guess means that Flair was watching Nitro from the mental institution. I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? That would be the choice of programming that would be airing in such a place. In another segment from the asylum, Scott Hall made a brief cameo as a patient wearing a hospital gown, and this was never spoken of again. In the main event, which did a far smaller number than the first title match earlier in the show, Randy Savage tosses a pair of brass knucks to DDP for him to use on Kevin Nash before getting the pin and winning back the WCW title. So in the span of 2 hours, DDP lost and won back the championship. A week later, Ric Flair got bailed out of the mental hospital by Arn Anderson. You learn something new every day. See, I didn't know you could just bail somebody out of an insane asylum. You could post bond. That doesn't seem very safe. I cannot understand how this company was no longer in business just 2 years later. Now, on a more serious note, Sting was asked by WCW not to wear his trademark black trench coat to the ring that night for the match, with this show coming a week after the Columbine High School shooting massacre, where two deranged students were part of what they called the Trench Coat Mafia, or at least one of them. Some kind of group called the Trench Coat Mafia. A WCW spokesman said, "This tragedy has deeply affected everyone in this country. WCW is glad to help out in any way that we can." That same night, Raw is War opened with a scrolling message on the screen that read as follows. "Earlier today, the World Wrestling Federation received a request from the parents of Matt Kechter to join them tonight in remembering their son, his friends, and classmates who lost their lives in the senseless tragedy at Columbine High School. The WWF joins parents, teachers, and community leaders in recognizing the importance of banding together to meet the needs of troubled teens. Violence is never an answer. Through communication, we will hopefully find a solution. In memory of all who lost their lives, we ask everyone to join us in a moment of silence." Matt and his brother Adam were huge WWF fans, and a company spokesman said that Matt's mom told me a very poignant story. When we had our pay-per-view Sunday night, Adam was sitting at home when the doorbell rang. The Columbine football team came by to take him to a neighbor's house so they could all watch it together. And the family also got phone calls from two of their favorite wrestlers, The Rock and Mick Foley. "Sadly, it has been one in a long line of school shootings in this country, which has been our great national disgrace." The following day, on April 27th, WWE taped its first ever edition, the pilot episode of a little show called SmackDown, which aired 2 days later on UPN. This was WWE's return to network television for the first time since 1992. Michael Cole and Jim Cornette did the commentary, a noteworthy show that featured the merger of the corporation and the Ministry of Darkness to form the Corporate Ministry. The show drew a 4.0 rating. It did less viewers than Raw was doing on cable at that time, or about 3.8 million viewers is what it did. UPN was averaging a little less than that at the time, so the number was good enough for them to greenlight SmackDown as a weekly series, which they did that August. 21 years ago this week, on April 30th, 2000. You know, WWE is calling Backlash this year WrestleMania Backlash. This show here in 2000, this was the real WrestleMania Backlash. This show is what WrestleMania should have been. Dean Malenko, the ladies' man, beat Scotty Too Hotty to retain his light heavyweight title. Hell of a finish, with Malenko hitting a super DDT off the top for the win. Big Show came out for his match with Kurt Angle to Hulk Hogan's Real American theme, dressed as the Showster Dude. Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit had an excellent battle for the Intercontinental title until the lame DQ finish. And in the main event, The Rock defeated Triple H to win the WWE Championship. Shane McMahon was the guest referee. Vince McMahon did everything he could to screw Rock out of the match, until Stone Cold Steve Austin finally showed up. He was supposed to be in The Rock's corner, but he did not show until very late, largely because they didn't want him distracting from the match and just standing around doing nothing. So they concocted some kind of storyline where Vince McMahon and all of his corporate cronies were talking like Austin wouldn't be there, like they had done something to him, but eventually he showed up. But also, keep in mind that Austin, at this point, was only 3 months removed from spinal fusion surgery, so he couldn't take any bumps. He should not have been out there at all. And when he finally walked out, I remember all the fat Austin jokes that people were making because he looked, he looked heavy. Which made sense because, of course, he couldn't train, so of course he looked heavy. But he obliterated everyone with a chair. Triple H, Pat Patterson, Gerald Briscoe, Shane, Vince. "You get a chair shot. You get a chair shot. Everybody gets a chair shot." From the moment that glass shattered to the moment the referee counted three, just this period of probably 3 or 4 minutes, the crowd would not stop making noise. It was the longest sustained reaction I had ever heard up to that point. Just pure pandemonium from start to finish. 15 years ago this week, on the May 1st, 2006 episode of Monday Night Raw, Joey Styles cut his famous worked shoot promo, quitting his job as the lead announcer on Raw. Now, back in October of 2005, Jim Ross got kicked in the balls by Linda McMahon on TV, and he was fired. He was storyline fired as the play-by-play announcer. This was because JR was having major colon surgery, which, of course, is what led to the embarrassing Dr. Heine skit. Anyway, that left a void open at the announce desk for WWE to fill, and Joey Styles, the voice of ECW, was tapped to be their replacement for Jim Ross to fill that void. And things seemed to be going fine until WrestleMania 22 rolled around when Styles got bumped from the show in favor of Jim Ross. Although they did at least allow Joey to help call the hardcore match with Edge and Mick Foley, which was probably the best match on the entire show. So he got to call his first and only WrestleMania match. But then, he was replaced again by JR on the Backlash pay-per-view. This was the one where Vince and Shane wrestled Shawn Michaels and God. Which is too bad, because it would have been the perfect place to hear a classic Joey Styles, "Oh my God!" I can't believe we missed out on that. On this night, on Raw, the Spirit Squad were the general managers of the show, and Kenny Dykstra was scheduled to challenge John Cena for the WWE Championship. And the Spirit Squad took to bullying Joey and telling him he needed to show some more spirit, especially when it came time to announce Kenny as the new champion. And if he didn't, they threatened to force him to wear a cheerleader outfit on Raw the following Monday. Now, this was in the back that this segment happened. Styles then walks back down to the ring, and Jerry Lawler is egging him on, and he's telling him, "Come on, Joey, show some more spirit." And Styles looked like he was about to explode. He just wanted to sit down, call wrestling, and do his job. And Lawler said, "Come on, Joey, show some more spirit." And again, Styles just looked to be getting angrier and angrier. Just ask JBL what happens when you make Joey mad. Finally, Joey had enough. He calls Lawler a hack. He starts shoving him. Lawler is laughing. He seems to be fine with it until Joey slaps him in the face. And then Lawler's entire demeanor changes. He shoves Styles backwards. He falls over the announce chair. And Joey marches to the back. They cut to commercial. They come back from break, and they replay the entire incident. And Lawler is standing at the announce desk, and he apologizes on the house mic. He apologizes for his actions. He tells Joey, "Come on back out." Styles walks out onto the stage with a mic in his hand, and he cuts one of the more memorable promos in Raw history. One that hits a little too close to home with the things that he was saying. This is what he had to say. He said, "You want to apologize? Like nothing happened, like you didn't knock me on my ass in front of millions of people worldwide, and I'm going to come down there and work with you? I'm not coming back. And now, thanks to the magic of live television, I'm going to show the whole world why for 7 years in ECW, I was the unscripted, uncensored, loose cannon of commentary. 6 months ago, WWE called me. I didn't call this company because I was looking for a job. I didn't need a job. WWE called me because they had humiliated and fired, again, Jim Ross. So I get JR's spot, and from week one, week after week, I've got an ongoing lecture about the differences in professional wrestling and sports entertainment. I'm not allowed to say pro wrestling. I'm not allowed to say wrestler. I have to say sports entertainment and refer to the wrestlers as superstars. I'm told to deliberately ignore the moves and the holds during the matches so that I can tell stories. Well, ignoring the moves and holds is damn insulting to the athletes, to the wrestlers, not the entertainers who leave their families 300 days a year to ply their craft in that ring. Here's the best part. Because I'm not a sports entertainment storyteller, I get pulled from WrestleMania. And the reason I'm given is because I don't sound like Jim Ross, who's the guy they fired in the first place. That makes sense, right? So I swallow that bitter pill. I'm a company guy. I got bumped from WrestleMania, but then I get bumped from Backlash. I'm not good enough to call Backlash? In ECW, I called live pay-per-views on my own, solo, no color commentators dragging me down. Wasn't done before me, hasn't been done since. But I'm not good enough to call Backlash because I'm not a sports entertainment storyteller? Well, you know what? I am sick of sports entertainment. I am sick of male cheerleaders, I am sick of boogers and bathroom humor and semen, and I am you know, out of context, people would wonder what the hell's that about, but he goes, I am sick of our chairman, who likes to talk about his own semen. He mocks God. He mocks God! And makes out with the divas, all to feed his own insatiable ego. I am sick of sports entertainment, and most of all, I am sick of you fans who actually buy into this crap. This sports entertainment circus. I never needed this job, and I don't want this job anymore. I quit. A lot of truth in that promo, which is really one of the ingredients of a great promo. And as he tried to collect himself, Lawler said they brought Joey Styles up from the gutter and maybe he'd feel more at home in a bingo hall kissing Paul Heyman's ass. And so ended the run of Joey Styles on Monday Night Raw, which cleared the way for them to use him for the ECW revival the following month when he joined Taz on commentary for the debut of that show on Sci-Fi. 13 years ago this week, on the May 1st, 2008 episode of TNA Impact, class was in session with Professor Steiner, Scott Steiner, and his famous Steiner Math promo, as he talked about the upcoming triple threat match at the Sacrifice pay-per-view with himself, Kurt Angle, and Samoa Joe, or as he used to call him, Smojo. Angle would end up being replaced before the match by Kazarian due to injury. This may have been the greatest gift that Scott Steiner has ever given to the wrestling business. This promo right here may well be his greatest contribution. Lauren Thompson was in the back with Steiner, Petey Williams, and Raka Khan to conduct this legendary interview that I shall read to you verbatim. If you found the Pythagorean theorem difficult in school, this may be hard to follow, but try to follow along. You know, they say all men are created equal. But you look at me and you look at Samoa Joe and you can see that statement is not true. See, normally if you go one-on-one with another wrestler, you got a 50-50 chance of winning. But I'm a genetic freak and I'm not normal. So you got a 25% at best at beating me. And then you add Kurt Angle to the mix, your chances of winning drastic go down. See, the three-way at Sacrifice, you got a 33 and a third chance of winning. But I got a 66 and two-thirds chance of winning, because Kurt Angle knows he can't beat me, and he's not even going to try. So, Samoa Joe, you take your 33 and a third chance minus my 25% chance, and you got an 8 and a third chance of winning at Sacrifice. But then you take my 75% chance of winning, if we was to go one-on-one, and then add 66 and two-thirds percents, I got a 141 and two-thirds chance of winning at Sacrifice. See, Joe, the numbers don't lie, and they spell disaster for you at Sacrifice. And with that, the field of mathematics was forever changed. He then went on to ask the ladies if they would rather be with him or with Samoa Joe. And Lauren said she thought Joe was kind of nice. And he said, see, you're one of those girls that likes romance. I'ma talk to all my freaks out there. Would you rather come home to me, a genetic freak, to be satisfied every night, or go home to that fat ass Samoa Joe? Scott Steiner, man. He is truly a gift. 9 years ago this week, on April 29th, 2012, two of my picks for WWE Match of the Year took place on the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, with Brock Lesnar wrestling his first match in a WWE ring in more than 8 years, taking on John Cena in the main event. their first meeting since 2003. And Sheamus defending the World Heavyweight title in a 2 out of 3 falls match against Daniel Bryan. This is what their WrestleMania match should have been. Those two had an excellent battle. Both matches were on my list at year's end, but it was really neck and neck between the Cena-Lesnar match and the Shield's in-ring debut at TLC in Brooklyn for a match of the year that year. Cena and Lesnar was a main event that was very unlike what we were used to seeing in WWE at that time. That's one of the things I loved about it, was how different it was. It felt like a fight. It felt like a battle. Lesnar opened up Cena early with an elbow to the head. Cena bled. Brock just toyed with him. There was a spot where Lesnar, using the ring steps that had been brought into the ring, did this leap where he was just supposed to knock Cena off the apron to the floor, but his momentum carried him out over the top rope, and Lesnar almost broke his own neck on the landing and tore his knee out. Cena ended up hitting him with a chain. That busted Brock open hard way, and he gave Brock an attitude adjustment on the ring steps for the win. A baffling finish, even though it probably shouldn't have been, given the way Brock left the company. I guess this was the price that had to be paid. But this, like I said, felt like a fight. It was violent. It was bloody. It was brutal. And I loved every second of it, except for that finish. It's been almost a decade. I have not warmed to the finish. Brock Lesnar should not have lost his first match back in a WWE ring. But there was also controversy after the match was over. Lesnar was said to be furious backstage about a few things. For one, when he went flying out of the ring, he blamed Cena for pulling the top rope down, causing him to fly out of the ring and almost blow out his knee. So he wasn't happy about that. But the other thing, the bigger thing, was the finish. And this comes per the Observer at the time. He was told that he was going to be protected because he would destroy Cena. He would lose, but he would destroy Cena. Cena would then have to be helped out of the ring to the back when the match was over, you know, to sell the beating. Instead, if you remember, John Cena cut this bizarre promo. And some people said, well, maybe he didn't realize he was still on the air, because the show was still on the air. It was like, and Cena did this a lot, you know, back then. If the show, let's say Monday Night Raw, went off the air, before the night was over and everybody was told to go home, Cena would get on the house mic and he would say something. He would cut a promo. He would say a few words. He would thank people for coming to the show, get home safe. Well, basically, he did that speech, that kind of speech, but he did it on the air here at the end of this pay-per-view. And it was just very, very weird. And he was talking as if he was, you might not see me for a while. I'm going to go away for a while. You know, the way he was holding his arm, I don't know, maybe he thought his arm was fucked and he might have a legitimate injury, which he didn't. I don't know. I remember his arm sort of hanging there like it was dead, but he may have just been selling. But then he was back on TV the very next night. He never even went away. But Brock was pissed. And when Mark Carano, the recently fired Mark Carano, tried to calm him down, Lesnar reportedly told him to suck a specific part of his anatomy that I shall leave to your imagination. And 3 years ago this week, on April 27th, 2018, WWE kicked off its new 10-year partnership with the Saudi General Sports Authority for a series of events that is still ongoing to be held in Saudi Arabia. The first of which being the Greatest Royal Rumble from Jeddah. John Cena beat Triple H in the opening match. The Undertaker beat Rusev in a casket match. That was the original match. And then Rusev was replaced by Chris Jericho. And people thought it may have had to do with Rusev posting a tweet after the match was initially announced saying, "Bury me softly, brother." Which he claims is not true. He didn't get in trouble for that. He wasn't, you know, he only posted that, he says, because it was a casket match and people took it the wrong way. But then Jericho got pulled from the match, and they switched it back to Rusev for what Rusev claims, and this is the reason Vince McMahon gave Jericho for the change, that the Saudi prince himself personally requested that Rusev be put back into the match. Yes, the same Saudi prince who allegedly loves having big names on his shows personally requested that Chris Jericho, a future Hall of Famer, be replaced by Rusev. Unless Saudi Arabia has some kind of beef with Bulgaria that I'm not aware of and he wanted to see Rusev get his ass handed to him, I'm going to have to call bullshit on that one. As does Jericho, who says the change just so happened to be made right after he told Vince McMahon that he was going to be working a second match for New Japan Pro Wrestling against Tetsuya Naito. Suddenly, Jericho found himself replaced by Rusev. And he was instead used in the Greatest Royal Rumble match later on that night. He still worked the show. It wasn't like he was taken off the show completely. He just didn't work against The Undertaker, which is a match that he was looking forward to because Jericho and The Undertaker never really worked together all that much. I think they had one television match on SmackDown, if I remember. And they had that interaction in that one Elimination Chamber match when Jericho won the belt back. And I think that might have been it. But you know what? Who knows? Jericho doesn't buy that excuse. Rusev claims that that's what he was told, that, you know, that they personally requested him be put back in the match. Rusev claims that he was even invited to dinner with the prince. Maybe the prince was a Rusev mark. You know what he's probably referring to. If you remember when all the wrestlers landed in Saudi Arabia, video leaked of this giant dinner where they were all being entertained. Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, Undertaker, were sitting at the head of the table with Vince McMahon. Shane and Triple H were on the other side. That's probably what he's referring. I mean, he makes it sound like he was personally invited to a one-on-one dinner with the prince. Maybe he was. But I find that very hard to believe. And Braun Strowman won the 50-man Greatest Royal Rumble match, a match that is most remembered for entrant number 39, Titus O'Neil, who tripped on his way down to the ring and slid underneath the ring in one of the funniest botches that I've ever seen. I've seen people trip and fall. I've never seen someone literally trip and slide under the ring. Corey Graves on commentary could barely contain himself. It wouldn't have been so funny if his head had struck the steel beam under the ring, which he only missed by a few inches if you watch it back. It was a steel beam right there. He just missed it, just narrowly missed it. But the only thing injured was Titus's ego. He will never live that down. He's part of history now. See, I would embrace it. I would just embrace it. When he goes, you know, if he goes into the Hall of Fame one day, I know he just got the Warrior Award treatment, but if he were to ever get his own Hall of Fame induction, which I could see one day, you know, if he stays with the company long enough, especially for all the PR work, and charity work that he does. Although I guess that's what the Warrior Award thing was for, but you know, if he ever goes back in, they put a big video package together. I mean, that's going to be front and center. You have to embrace it. You made your mark. You will be remembered forever. You will live on now. You are immortalized in WWE history. I can think of worse things to be immortalized for. But that is this week in wrestling history. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. And if you want to become a Sound Off channel member on YouTube, you may do so. We have two different membership tiers offering various perks. I've been getting some new content up there. There's more retro audio, the lost episodes of the Sound Off. You can't find these anywhere else. Audio that goes back to 2007, 2008. I'm uploading new audio every single week. Probably start working on those old SE Scoops live shows soon. I used to do those post-Raw shows on Monday nights. There's only 34 of those. We'll start getting those up soon for our Sound of Legend tier members. More Q&As. I did a 40-minute Q&A about a week ago, taking members' questions, members-only questions. And I'm working on a couple of other cool things as well. We had a really good month in April, so I want to thank everybody who did sign up and become a channel member. It's very much appreciated. So if you're interested, You'll see the little join. It's like a white join button. It's pretty much underneath any video on the channel. If you click that, it'll give you all the information you need. I'm going to be back with you for a brand new podcast, as I am every Sunday. Next Sunday is Mother's Day. It is a special Mother's Day episode of The Sound Off. That'll be episode 703. So I hope you will all spend some time with your moms and tell them that you love them and enjoy the day and find some time to squeeze in The Sound Off. I always say my favorite episode I ever did, episode 495, Mother's Day Madness. That's in the archives. You could listen to that right now. And of course, this Wednesday is the Blood and Guts episode of Dynamite, big show. I will be live on YouTube as I am every Wednesday as soon as that show goes off the air talking all of the results. And I think that about covers it for this week. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Thank you for all your continued support. And I will see you for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Salamonster Sounds Off.
The Great Kali. When I think back to all those Kali moments, I mean, we've got the, well, you know, there was the time that he, who can forget that great, you know, how about I just share a story? Big Show sees Kali walk in. He says, "Hey, motherfucker, why do you keep stealing my spots? That's bullshit. You can't even do any of it properly anyway because you're the fucking shits."
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Salamonster on Twitter @Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.